seated. Good morning. Our first case for today is 2025-30408, Louisiana Shrimp Association et al. Versus Howard Lutnick et al. We'll hear from Mr. St. John first.
May it please the court, Scott St. John for the Louisiana Shrimp Association and the individual shrimpers. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you ask A.C. Cooper and the shrimpers what this was about, they'd say it's about their livelihood and whether they'll stay in business. But it's much more about the rule of law. First, whether an agency can circumvent the APA and its bar on ipsy-dixit by having its employees attend a boondoggle conference, sit around a table, pull some numbers out of thin air, and then vote on them. That's the Stacey Report. And that's the basis for the rule here. No agency, to my knowledge, has so brazenly attempted to circumvent the APA, so this is a novel question. Second, when commenters hear the Shrimp Association called the agency's hand by identifying the mortality numbers that resulted from that conference and said they were arbitrary, and that's what the Shrimp Association did, it's at page 8848 of the record, was the agency obligated to specifically respond to that comment? There's nothing novel at all there. The answer is yes. That's Texas Corn Producers and American Public Gas. NOAA's failure to do so requires vacature. Start with the burden. Under this court's case in Chamber of Commerce, the agency must show that it reasonably considered the relevant issues and reasonably explained its decision. It must respond to comments that can be thought to challenge a fundamental premise of the rule. In court, that typically takes the form of pointing out in the brief, here is where in the record these numbers came from, and here is where we responded to the comment. That's what Judge Smith said he expected in Texas Corn Producers. And that's not what we have here. Instead, the agency and its amici activists, in cant words like deference, technical expertise, and asked the court to parrot back what the agency said. My four-year-old would say that should set off your spidey sense. The APA requires you to peek behind the curtain. The agency never identifies the basis for challenged numbers anywhere in its brief. There's nothing there. Instead, the agency encants it did a holistic analysis. And that should go beyond spidey sense to a blaring alarm. It should trigger Judge Oldham's Louisiana v. DOE. You can't silently balance a bunch of different factors. You have to explain what you did. So the rule fails, regardless of whether you look at it under a substantial evidence analysis or an arbitrary and capricious analysis.
Why wouldn't our case law support a substantial evidence analysis here?
Because you have a number that is plucked out of thin air, actually three numbers, 10%, 50%, 80%.
What case says that if numbers are plucked out of thin air, and I'm just accepting that for the purpose of the question, you don't use the substantial evidence standard?
Well, I would point to two. In this court's cases, Career Colleges says an agency can't just encant its expertise. It can't encant its experience. There has to be something underlying that. And a more specific example is the DC Circuit's American Public Gas. There was an 80 BTU number. He said, where did this come from? Please point us in the record where this number came from. It was attacked by a commenter. The agency didn't. So the DC Circuit vacated the rule. That's what we have here. We have numbers that we've challenged, plucked out of thin air, and there's no response to where they came from.
What evidence would have justified this rule? What were you looking for?
The agency chose to proceed with a quantitative analysis. It used numbers to calculate the purported deaths of turtles and balance that against numbers of economic harm. I would expect some empirical evidence showing those numbers are tied to reality. It can't just be we're going to sit around a conference table and vote on some numbers.
How did they quantify the number of dead turtles?
So the agency's kind of full process was they started with the samples. They observe how many turtles are captured and how many hours does it take to capture those number of turtles, and then calculate a number of turtles captured per hour. And it's some thousandths of a turtle. And then what they do know is how many hours of shrimping effort are expended over the season. Multiply those, and that gets the total number of turtles that were interacted with shrimp nets. Where they went off the rails is they then said, okay, we're going to assume that at least 10% of those die after release. The turtle's put back in the water, it swims away happy, I'm out of the net, I'm gonna go eat some more fish. They just assumed 10% die. And they assume that some fraction of turtles, if they have some type of injury to them, half are gonna die. And some other group, 80% are gonna die. Where those numbers came from are thin air, particularly the 50 and the 80. The agency acknowledges that there is zero empirical support for those.
How could they determine the percentage of turtles that died after they got out of the net? Like the little turtles that got out, but then maybe they got damaged.
So the one piece of empirical evidence anywhere in here is called Snoddy and Willard, 2010. A scientist captured turtles in a net, forced them to stay in the net for a period of time, mounted a radio transceiver on their backs, and then cut them loose. One died. And then they inferred that some others may have died based on their behavior. So, I mean, that's the only piece of empirical analysis. That's the basis for the 10%, the 50 and 80, nowhere. And so the answer to your question is, I don't know how you would do that. That seems to be the best way, but it was the agency's burden, having decided to proceed with this numerical analysis, to justify its numbers. And that's the gap. There is no justification for the numbers. You know, the kind of the tell here is the agency doesn't say the turtles actually died. It uses much less definitive language. In the rule, it says that turtle mortality may be higher. It could be higher. That's the language of speculation. And one of the takeaways from last term's Waggis and White Lion case is that the court is supposed to carefully parse what the agency said. And that cuts both ways. Here the agency used speculative language, which is probably correct because there's no actual empirical evidence. And so we're stuck with the agency speculating it. There's no there.
Do you have anything else, Mr. St. John?
I did want to zoom in on a couple of other things. The imaginary numbers didn't... They were known for a while, put it like that. The agency traces back to a 2009 conference. It was the same thing. Sitting around
what are
a table.
You talking about imaginary numbers? I'm sorry, it's kind of...
10%, 50%, 80%.
I'm just, what are you, yeah, what are you, can you be more
the
specific?
The portion of the turtles that purportedly die when they're released from the nets. Numbers, they call them mortality criteria, plucked out of thin air. And I'm going to call them imaginary numbers because I don't know what else to call them.
Okay, the mortality criteria is what you're talking about.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just want to follow what your point is.
My apologies. The origins for those were a conference in 2009. They published the first example of sitting around the table in 2011. So this was a known thing that when the agency withdrew an earlier iteration of this rule was known.
Didn't they cite two other studies that post-date the 2013 proposed rule withdrawal?
And
did they?
They did, and I led with my chin on that in the opening brief. I don't think you can circumvent this problem by saying, hey, here's a bibliography, we're gonna throw in some stuff from years later. The agency bears the burden of tying that later information to its rule. It's another version of circumvention. The agency can't just say, hey, here's a study, I'm not gonna tell you if it's related or not, from 2016, 2018, and here are our numbers over here. There's no connection. And in fact, when you peek behind the covers, one of the studies they cite deals with decompression sickness in turtles. We're talking about inshore waters in Louisiana here. The agency defined water that would be of concern for decompression sickness as more than 30 meters deep. I hope I don't need to tell anybody that here in the bayou, we're not talking about waters 30 meters deep. So I think that kind of encapsulates what happened, where things were shoved into a bibliography that have no real relation to the agency's decision, and specifically don't provide any support for the numbers that are at issue here.
And what relief do you seek, sir?
Vacature of the rule, vacature and set aside. That's the APA's statutory relief, and this court presumes that vacature and set aside are the correct relief for an APA violation. And if there are no further questions, I will sit down.
Let me just ask you one thing. Is the 219 rule stayed pending this litigation?
No, Your Honor. There was a brief preliminary injunction in the state's litigation based on hurricane, and the shrimpers physically could not obtain the nets. So there was a six-month TRO or PI, but that is gone years ago. The rule is currently in effect.
Okay, thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Turner.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Frederick Turner for the United States. This court should uphold the National Marine Fisheries Service's 2019 rule for three reasons. First, the administrative record fully supports the agency's decision-making. Contrary to plaintiffs' assertions in their briefs and again here today, the rule is based on numerous sources of data, and the agency fully responded to the comments. Second, the rule strikes a reasonable balance between costs and benefits. Importantly, the agency narrowed the scope of the proposed rule after considering the economic impacts. In the final rule, TEDs, or turtle excluder devices, are required only for a limited number of vessels, those that are greater than or equal to 40 feet in length. Third, plaintiffs' arguments about reliance interest and extra record evidence overlook the relevant record evidence and ignore the record review rule. The National Marine Fisheries Service has issued a narrowly tailored rule. The D.C. Circuit has already upheld the rule in a separate challenge brought by conservation groups, and we urge the court to do the same here. I'd like to turn first to the record evidence, but before I do, I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about the prior rulemaking just to set the scene for this evidence. In 1987, the agency believed that TEDs would function as effectively in inshore waters as they would in offshore waters. However, NIMS recognized that it did not have observer data for the skimmer trawls that were operating in the inshore waters, and thus did not require it in the final rule. So that was 1987. Fast forward to 2012, the agency again considered requiring TEDs for all skimmer trawl vessels operating in inshore waters, but eventually withdrew the rule. It did so this time because of a technological issue with the TEDs. Specifically, the small turtles, the Kemp's Ridley, were swimming through the TED, thus defeating the whole purpose of the device and getting captured in the net. So around this time, the agency began to collect observer data from the skimmer trawls. Right? This feeds back into my my history here. They did not have this observation data in the prior iterations of the rulemaking, but they thought it was important to go out and observe capture and mortality in the skimmer trawls, and that's exactly what they did. And this brings me to my first point about the record evidence, which I think is very important, and there's ample evidence in the record supporting this rule. The observer data is particularly important, and I think it's particularly noteworthy that the plaintiffs in their reply brief continue to ignore the observer data. There was observers on skimmer trawl vessels from 2012 to 2014 that provided valuable information to the agency regarding both capture and mortality of the turtles. There was also observer data from North Carolina. And I'll just point out some record sites from the record on appeal for the observer data, 11136 to 65, 11108 to 35, 1166 to 99. Those are the Gulf observer reports. And then for the North Carolina, 10128 to 63. But that's not all. In addition, the National Marine Fisheries Service relied on reports and studies regarding turtle mortality. In particular, the agency relied on the Stacey report from 2016. And since that was discussed by opposing counsel, I thought I'd just take a moment to discuss that in a little more detail. But before I do, I'll just point the court's attention to the heart of the analysis in that document, Record on Appeal 11212 to 22. And in this report, you see a detailed assessment of this issue of post-interaction mortality. What is post-interaction mortality? That's the scenario where a turtle has been captured in the shrimp fishing net, but it has not been killed. In other words, it has not drowned while it's in the net, or it does not come on the deck of the vessel dead. So it could be released and go back into the water. And there is a possibility that it would survive. But there's also a distinct possibility, and this is borne out by the scientific studies, that the turtle will die after the interaction with the net.
What are those studies in the record that show what happens to the turtles after they're released?
Well,
the question Judge Clement was asking earlier.
Yes, Your Honor. The Stacey report brings together, synthesizes a lot of the studies regarding post-interaction mortality. And those pages that I cited earlier describe those studies and assess the three categories of post-interaction mortality. Before I go further, I should also make sure to point the court's attention to the NIMS directive from 2017, which is another important document referenced in the final rule, where the agency sends out a directive across the country to all the regional offices of the National Marine Fisheries Service and let them know what the three criteria are, how to assess them, and that document was submitted by the plaintiffs. That's at ECF 33-2.
Okay, we got the criteria. Mm-hmm. What do the studies show, and where in the record can we find that? Of what happens to the ones that are released, the little ones that are released, and how do we know they die?
Well, we don't. These are percentages, likelihood.
How do we know the percentages? What studies do you have in the record that support the idea that some of them, a certain percentage of them, die?
Well, these are the Stacey report, and I'll describe that in a little more detail to describe the genesis of that.
This is really important, so I would not gloss over this. This is that you need to really hone in if there are studies that show a percentage of the turtles die and how they study that.
There are, in addition to the Stacey report, at the end of the Stacey report, there is a set of documents that are referenced at Record on Appeal 11310 to 15. Those are the studies that the Stacey report was synthesizing in those earlier pages that I referenced.
Can you remind me the date of the Stacey report?
That was 2016.
So what are we supposed to make? I'm glad you brought up the docket 33-1. So the way I read the preambulatory introductory explanation of how this all came to be is that there was an expert workshop convened by the Greater Atlantic Regional Fisheries Office in 2009. And so the categories, this 10, 50, 80, is, according to this report, the 2017 directive you mentioned, we're coming up with these categories of 10, 50, 80 mm-hmm. before the Stacey report and before the 2014 observational data.
Correct. That, and I'm glad you raised that, Your Honor. That does go, that is discussed in the NIMS directive in 2017, because as I mentioned, that NIMS directive is a directive that's meant to apply across the country. The regional study that was very important in informing that NIMS directive. And the workshop that led to the Stacey report occurred in 2015. And I do want to pause for a moment just to describe, this is not a, as opposing counsel suggested, government employees just sitting around coming up with numbers out of thin air. This is a thoughtful exercise of folks from outside the government, sea turtle biologists, folks, wildlife veterinarians, who are experts in knowing what happens when a turtle is injured or comes into contact with a net but is not killed while it's in the net.
I hear you, but I guess I'm hung up on the same thing that Chief Judge Elrod is asking you. I guess Judge Clement, too. Mm-hmm. It's like, I hear that, mm-hmm. but then the question is, can you show the work somehow? Mm-hmm. Because what I'm reading in this is, well, we had a big workshop. We've been doing this since 2009. We're going to stick with the 10. I take it in 2009, we also had the 10, 50, 80 is risk category 1, 2, 3, excuse me.
Right. There was some variation as a result of the workshop. As I recall, there was a additional category of 20% for those interactions that occurred in deeper waters, because mm-hmm. at that point, it's more likely that the turtle will die than it is if it's closer to shore.
But
yes, otherwise it's the same three categories.
So I don't mean to put words in your mouth. I've not read these studies. I've just looked at your citations of them in the NIMS directive. And I take it that if I went and read these studies carefully, they would all sort of support this idea of the 1, 2, 3 or the 10, 50, 80.
Well, I think it's not just those numbers are established by the agency as they're going through and trying to determine what level of mortality or what prediction are we going to make. Mm-hmm. A lot of the studies talk about what happens when a turtle interacts with a net. And it's not as simple as they die or they don't.
Mm-hmm. It's a risk.
And you're right. And I think that's what the studies are digging into. What is the level of harm after the turtle swims away, if it can swim away? Now, some of these turtles might be comatose and not able to move, but still alive. So I think—
Is that from the decompression sickness? That's what the DCS references are?
That is a related issue. That's not as common in the shallower water. So that's not as relevant to this—
I was worried about that. Yeah. As we point out, these are not deep waters.
Right. But there is, it is, shown through these studies that there are impacts and harms to turtles after they come into contact with the net.
Which vessels now are subject to the tow time restrictions?
So the tow time restrictions would apply to all the skimmer trawls that are less than 40 feet in length and the other categories of trawl vessels.
So mostly inshore?
Right, so the vast majority of the skimmer trawls are still subject to the tow time restrictions. Okay. And I do want to point out that another important piece of evidence is that the tow time restrictions are not as effective as the agency thought they might be at preventing capture and mortality. There is quite a bit of evidence that those engaged in shrimp fishing with the trawler nets are not complying with the tow times. And when they go beyond the permitted tow time, that means that if there is a turtle or turtles in the net, that they are more and increasingly likely to die either in the net or afterward. The studies show that the more time that the turtle spends underwater without being able to breathe, the more likely it is to die. So the agency has determined, in addition to the observer data, in addition to the post-interaction mortality data, that these tow time restrictions simply are not as effective at preventing capture and mortality. But I do want to take the moment to recognize that the agency did pull back the proposed rule. It would have applied to all of those vessels that I just mentioned, all the skimmer trawls, all the pusher head trawls, and all the wingnet trawls. And as part of its cost-benefit analysis, determined that that was going to be too impactful on the shrimp fishing industry, and decided that it was important not to have the too high of a burden on the on those operators of vessels. In fact, the final rule reduced the number of affected vessels by 82% as compared to the proposed rule, and reduced the economic impact by 73%. And I think it's important to note that while the agency's choice to minimize this economic impact also meant that it was reducing the conservation benefit, right? And that's why we had the challenge in DC. So the conservation groups were saying, this rule is not protective enough, right? You could be saving more turtles if you applied it to all the skimmer trawls, or even a greater subset of skimmer trawls. You would save more turtles. And you have an obligation under the Endangered Species Act to protect the turtles, which are, after all, listed as either threatened or endangered. And the court rejected that argument. The court said our role is not to decide who has the better policy argument, and upheld the agency's cost-benefit analysis, which I just described, this ratcheting back from the proposed rule to the final rule. I'd also like to take a moment to address my third and final argument, which is the reliance interest and the extra record information. Even assuming the plaintiffs have reliance interests, NIMS examined them. This is found in the record on appeal at 2101 to 19. That's the social impact analysis, and 2045 to 2100. That's the economic analysis. The court also should reject plaintiffs' effort to rely on extra record evidence, particularly the bycatch data, which was introduced to the agency only after the final rule was issued. This court has made clear in Gust versus Verity and Medina County that courts are not permitted to consider evidence outside the record, and the court should not do so here. And since I mentioned Gust versus Verity, I think I'll just end there and go back in time. That was a case challenging that very first rule that I mentioned, the 1987 rule. And in that case, the court upheld the methodology applied by the agency to predict the number of captures of turtles in the waters in the Gulf and the South Atlantic. And I think it's a relevant precedent for this court. It relied on the agency's expertise, technical expertise, in determining the number of captures that would occur, and the extrapolation based on the number of captures and the amount of fishing effort that was occurring in the offshore waters. So if the court has no further questions, we ask that the court uphold the rule and affirm the district court.
Thank you. We have your argument. Mr. Turner. Mr. St. John, you've saved time for rebuttal.
A few quick points. My colleague concedes that this was a balancing cost and benefits. The challenge here is, what's the justification for the claimed numeric benefits? His response to your question, Judge Elrod, where in the record? Where's the specific study? Well, there was one page range of 29 pages, one page range of 27 pages, one page range of 33 pages, pointing to vast swaths of the record. Where is the single citation that supports these mortality criteria, that supports the numbers? The silence is the concession. There was no specific, look at ROA 12345. Look at this particular page. My colleague did not make that statement because there is no support for the numbers. He instead talks about a report that brings together evidence, synthesizes. That's a dodge for there is no evidence here. Points to the directive
that we've sought judicial notice of. It's what you call citation laundering. You take something and you put it in another, you reference it in another document, then you reference that document, but then when you follow it back to the root, there's no there there. Turns out it was a Dear Abby column from 1962. There's no empirical evidence. There was some discussion, Judge Oldham, about the Garfo publication. It's UPITE. It's in the record at ROA 12463. In the 2014 biological opinion, the agency made a conscious choice not to use the numbers in there. And that's at ROA 11546, because it said that the observer data that's being cited here wasn't good enough to match with the criteria. So you end up with nonsense on both sides. You have arbitrary criteria on one side, and then on the other side of that, you have data that the agency itself has determined is of such poor quality. They said it was unscientific, it wasn't collected in an organized manner, that you can't pair the two. Finally, my colleague pointed to tow time ineffectiveness. That's been known. That's been known, like, that there would be, that some shrimpers were not going to adhere. That was raised in the 1987 rule. It was known in 2012. The observer data in 2012 was that despite a fairly high rate of noncompliance, it was 65% noncompliance, 24 of 24 turtles that were captured were released alive. This is a problem that was known. So there hasn't been a change. And absent a change, what's the explanation for the agency's change in position? And it's these mortality criteria that we have no explanation for. If there are no questions from the panel, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. St. John. We have your argument. This case is submitted, and we appreciate the arguments on both sides.